were no more than 8 black feet in the immediate area, and he was convinced that we could manage that number should they attempt any hostile measures. The late July sun was starting to sink in the west. Lewis proposed that they camp together. That was agreed to. On the way down the steep bluff, they picked up Driar, Field, and the Indian. They came to a delightful spot on a bend in the river, a bowl-shaped bottomland with 3 large cottonwoods in the center and excellent grass. The Blackfeet made a rough dome with willow branches, threw some dressed buffalo skins over it, and invited the whites to join them in the shelter. Driar and Lewis accepted. The Field brothers lay near the fire in front of the shelter. Lewis went to work. With Driar flashing the signs, he asked question after question. The Blackfeet said they were part of a large band that was one day's march away, near the foot of the mountains. They said there was a white man in their band. Another large band of their nation was hunting buffalo on its way to the mouth of Maria's River, where it would be in a few days. Lewis had no way to judge how much of this was meant to intimidate him, how much was true. If it was all true, it meant he was in the middle of the Blackfeet Nation, and that a Canadian trader was living with one band, which meant that they surely had many firearms. This group of 8 had 2 muskets. Lewis asked about the trading patterns of the Blackfeet. The boys informed him that they rode 6 days' easy march to reach a British post on the North Saskatchewan River, and that from the traders there, they obtain arms, ammunition, spirituous liquor, blankets, etc., in exchange for wolves and some beaver skins. This was unwelcome news. It reinforced Jefferson's worst fears, that agents of the Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company were firmly entrenched on the northern plains and were rapidly extending their monopoly. But it gave Lewis an opportunity, which he characteristically seized. He told the Blackfeet in great detail how much better a deal they would get from the Americans once the Americans arrived on the high plains. He gave his peace speech. He said he had come from the rising sun and gone to where the sun set and had made peace between warring nations on both sides of the mountains. He said he had come to their country to invite the Blackfeet to join the American Empire. To all of this, as he understood them, they readily gave their assent. The braves were willing to talk the sign language as long as the smoking continued. They were extremely fond of tobacco, so Lewis plied them with the pipe until late at night. He let them know he had reinforcements in the area, a party of soldiers he would be meeting at the mouth of the Marias. He asked them to send 2 messengers to the nearby bands of Blackfeet to ask them to meet in 3 days at the mouth of the Marias River for a council about peace and trade. Perhaps a few chiefs would be willing to accompany the expedition to St. Louis and go on to visit their new father in Washington. Lewis concluded by asking the other 6 warriors to accompany him to the mouth of the Marias and promised them 10 horses and some tobacco if they would do these things. To this proposition they made no reply, Lewis recorded. Lewis had just made a serious political mistake. He had told these youngsters that he had organized their traditional enemies, the Nez Perce, the Shoshones, others, into an American-led alliance. Worse, he had indicated that the Americans intended to supply these enemies with rifles. The Blackfoot monopoly on firearms, based on their exclusive access to British suppliers, would be broken. As James Rhonda puts it, the clash of empires had come to the Blackfeet. After more than 20 years of being the bully boys of the High Plains country, they were being challenged, as were their British friends. Lewis took the first watch. He wrote in his journal 2,000 words about the day. He covered it from start to finish with frequent interruptions to the narrative. In one paragraph, he compared the quality of water in Cutbank Creek and Two Medicine River. He made an astute ecological observation. Here in the eastern foothills of the Rocky Mountains was the only place that the 3 major cottonwood species grew together. Mainly, though, he described what had happened in an after-action report. At 11:30, he roused Reuben Field. He ordered Field to watch the movements of the Indians, and if one of them left camp, to awake the party, lest the Indians attempt to steal the detachment's horses. Then he lay down and immediately fell into a profound sleep.
"Damn you! Let go my gun!"
Driar's shout woke Lewis. It was a few minutes past first light. Lewis jumped up. He saw Driar scuffling with an Indian over a rifle. Lewis reached for his rifle but found it gone. He drew his horse pistol from its holster, looked up, and saw a second Indian running off with his rifle. Lewis ran at him and signaled to him when he turned that he would either lay down that rifle or get shot. As the Indian started to lay the rifle down, the Field brothers came running up in a state of the highest excitement. They aimed their rifles at the Indian, but before they could shoot, Lewis called out to stop them. The Indian was complying with his order. Driar came up, breathless and excited, asking permission to kill the Indian. Lewis forbade it. The party had recovered its rifles. The Indians were falling back. "What happened?" Lewis demanded. The explanation came in a rush of words. Joseph Field had carelessly laid down his rifle beside his sleeping brother at absolutely the worst possible moment, first light. A watching Indian had seized his opportunity to grab it and Reuben Field's rifle and run off. At the same instant, Driar said, he woke to see two Indians stealing his rifle and Lewis's. He chased the Indian, caught him, and took back his own rifle while Lewis was recovering his. The Field brothers, meanwhile, had dashed after the Indian carrying off their rifles. At 50 yards, they caught him and wrestled the rifles out of his hands. Reuben pulled his knife and plunged it into the young warrior's heart. The Indian, Field later said, drew but one breath, and the wind of his breath followed the knife, and he fell dead. But Lewis didn't have an opportunity to hear this report, because before the brothers finished, he noticed that the Indians were attempting to drive off his horses. Lewis called out orders.
Shoot those Indians if they try to steal our horses!
The Field brothers ran after the main party of Indians, who were driving four of their horses up the river. Lewis ran after two men who were driving off the remainder of the horses, including Lewis's. He sprinted for some 300 yards, at which point the Indians had reached the almost vertical bluff. They hid in a niche, a sort of alcove, in the bluff, driving the horses before them. Lewis, breathless, could pursue no farther. He shouted to them, as he had done several times already, that he would shoot them if they did not give back his horse. How much, if any, of this the Blackfeet understood cannot be said. What happened was that an Indian jumped behind a rock and said something to his companion. That man was armed with a British musket loader. He turned toward Lewis. Lewis brought his rifle to his shoulder, aimed, and fired. He shot the warrior through the belly. But the Blackfoot was not finished. He raised himself to his knee, took a quick aim, and fired at Lewis. Being bareheaded, as Lewis commented, I felt the wind of his bullet very distinctly. Since there were two Indians, one badly wounded, and they were armed and behind good shelters, and he wanted to get out of there, and his shot pouch was back at camp so he could not reload, Lewis decided to retreat. He made his way back to camp. There he told Driar to run and call the Field brothers back. They had enough horses. Driar tried, but they were too far away to hear. Lewis and Driar went to work saddling the horses. The Field brothers returned with four of the party's original horses. Lewis cast his eye over the herd and selected four Indian horses and three of his original bunch. As the men arranged saddles and the placement of the baggage on the pack horses, Lewis started burning the articles the Indians had left behind. Onto the fire went four shields, two bows, two quivers of arrows, sundry other articles. Only the musket the warriors had abandoned and the flag Lewis had given an Indian the previous evening escaped the fire. Those he took with him. Enraged at the Indian treachery, he left the medal he had given out at last night's campfire hanging around the neck of the dead Indian, that they might be informed who we were. But excited as he was, Lewis wasn't about to take a scalp, though he did cut off the amulets from the shields before throwing the shields on the fire and put them in his pack as a war souvenir. An after-action analysis of Lewis's first-ever Indian fight indicates that he and his men made many mistakes. The first and most important was Joseph Field's. It was inexcusable for the sentinel ever to lay down his rifle, immeasurably more so when in the presence of young Indians. One would have thought that, after 2 years in the wilderness, Lewis would have had that pounded into the head of every enlisted man. Lewis's failure to give orders that he and the other sleeping men should be woken at first light was a grave error. It was his clear duty and responsibility to be up, alert, and in full command at this most dangerous moment in the day. Once awake, he made a number of snap judgments, some of them showing restraint and good sense, others demonstrating his sometimes impetuous nature. His first order was exactly right: get the rifles back. However dangerous it might be to chase an Indian carrying a rifle, those rifles were indispensable. His second order, forbidding the Field brothers and Driard to kill a retreating Indian who had laid down the stolen rifle, was also exactly right. Next to getting the rifles back and not losing the horses, avoiding bloodshed was clearly Lewis's first responsibility, and of course it was his commander-in-chief's direct order. At this time in the fight, Lewis did not yet know that Private Field had stabbed an Indian to death. When the Blackfeet started running off the horses, they were again attempting to steal what was indispensable to life on the plains. It is not so clear this time, however, that Lewis's immediate order to chase the Indians and get those horses back was necessary. There were 40 horses in the bottom, milling about in little groups. The thieves were never going to get them together into a herd and drive it off. While they were gathering horses, Lewis could have had his men doing the same. He later admitted that the Indian horse he took carried me very well, in short, much better than my own would have done, and leaves me with but little reason to complain of the robbery. But at the time, he didn't feel that way at all. He held the campsite, which contained all the equipment from both parties. The Indians were in full retreat. Lewis might have decided, let's get some horses for ourselves and let the Blackfeet go and get out of here. Instead, he ordered pursuit. The Field brothers took off after the main party, which had crossed the river. Lewis was fortunate that the young men, with their adrenaline pumping, didn't kill one or two more warriors. His decision to leave the campsite himself to pursue two Indians leading away one of his horses and three or four of theirs was questionable. He left his command post and exposed himself to harm for what was not indispensable. But his blood was up. 300 yards is a long way to sprint when wearing tight leather leggings and carrying a rifle over the thieving Indians. Whether he had to shoot the warrior or not is unclear. Lewis's narrative of this fight is one of his best pieces of writing, with lots of drama and detail. One detail we don't get, however: what was the Indian doing just before Lewis shot him? Lewis does not say. If he was taking aim at Lewis, obviously Lewis had to fire. But if his musket wasn't at his shoulder, Lewis should not have fired. Another missing detail: sometime before he fired his rifle, Lewis fired his pistol, but he does not say when. It seems most likely that he fired at the backs of the Indians as they were driving the horses toward the bluff. Another blunder: leaving the medal that they might be informed who we were was an act of taunting and boasting that put into serious jeopardy the entire American Empire scheme Lewis was concocting. To turn the most powerful tribe on the upper Missouri into enemies of the United States was Lewis's biggest mistake. Lewis made no analysis of his actions. He was content to describe them with his characteristic honesty. He wasn't in the habit of justifying his decisions, although he usually explained his reasons for them. In this case, the only thing he felt needed explaining was why he didn't have his shot pouch with him when he fired. He was very defensive about this, almost as if he felt it was the only thing he had done wrong and he wanted to make sure everyone understood it couldn't have been helped, because he had no time to return to camp after recovering his rifle before he started chasing the Indians driving off the horses. One Indian boy killed, another with a presumably fatal wound. Four whites in the middle of a land with hundreds of Blackfoot warriors who would seek revenge the instant they heard the news. It was imperative that Lewis get himself and his men out of there, immediately. Off they rode up the bluff to a beautiful level plain and on toward the mouth of the Marias. Lewis knew he had to get there as soon as possible, in the hope of meeting with the canoes and party at that place, because he had no doubt the Blackfoot party would ride at top speed to the nearest band to report. He anticipated that, on hearing the news, a large party of warriors would immediately set out to kill any white men they could find. He feared there was a band of Blackfeet between him and the Marias, a band already headed toward the mouth of the river. If they discovered Sergeant Ordway's canoe party coming down from the falls, the soldiers would not be alert to their danger and might well be overwhelmed. The party retreated at a trot, covering about 8 miles per hour. Fortunately, recent rains had left little reservoirs scattered about, the prickly pears were few, and there were not many rocks and stones. They rode through the morning and midday, not stopping until 3 o'clock p.m., when they suffered our horses to graze and took some refreshment. They had covered 63 miles. After an hour and a half break, they mounted up and rode off to cover 17 more miles by dark. Then they killed a buffalo and ate, mounted up again and set off, this time at a walk. It was a night to remember. The tension was high, so too the concentration. The setting was magical. The plains were as flat as a bowling green. There were thunderclouds and lightning on every quarter but that from which the moon gave us light. Throughout the night, we continued to pass immense herds of buffalo. At 2 a.m. on July 28th, Lewis finally ordered a halt. The day had begun for the party at first light about 3:30 a.m. on July 27th. The captain and his men had had an Indian fight to start the day, followed by a 100-mile ride. "We now turned out our horses," Lewis concluded his journal description of the day, "and laid ourselves down to rest in the plain very much fatigued, as may be readily conceived." Inexcusably and inexplicably, he did not post a sentinel. Lewis slept soundly, but only briefly. He woke at first light to find he was so stiff he could scarcely stand. He woke the men and told them to saddle up so they could get going. They, too, complained of stiffness and asked for more rest. I encouraged them by telling them that our own lives, as well as those of our friends and fellow travelers, depended on our exertions at this moment. That worked. They came alert, and the march was resumed. As they rode, Lewis exhorted. I now told them that we must risk our lives on this occasion. I told them that it was my determination that if we were attacked in the plains, that the bridles of the horses should be tied together and we would stand and defend them, or sell our lives as dear as we could. That proved unnecessary. At 12 miles, they came to the Missouri, rode down it another 8 miles, and heard the report of several rifles very distinctly. We quickly repaired to this joyful sound, and on arriving at the bank of the river, had the unspeakable satisfaction to see our canoes coming down. Lewis's party joined Sergeant Ordway's. The combined force consisted of 16 men. There were heartfelt greetings, but brief. Lewis explained the need for haste. The men quickly took the baggage from the horses and put it in the canoes, turned the horses loose, and set off. They went down the river to the mouth of the Marias, where they opened the caches from the previous summer. Some skins and furs were badly damaged, but the gunpowder, corn, flour, pork, and salt were in fairly good order. Back into the canoes, the white pirogue and 5 small canoes, and downstream as fast as possible. At 15 miles, Lewis reckoned that they had left the Blackfeet safely behind and made camp, prudently on the south bank across the river from any Blackfeet. That night there was a thunderstorm that lasted for hours. Lewis had no shelter of any kind. He just lay in the water all night. Lewis's exploration of the Marias was over. All in all, it had been a big mistake from the start. Many things went wrong, and nothing had been accomplished. Chapter 30. The Last Leg. July 29th to September 22nd, 1806. The job now was to reunite with Clark and his party and head on to the Mandan villages. In the morning, Lewis got an early start. The current being strong and the men anxious to get on, they plied their oars faithfully, and we went at the rate of about 7 miles an hour. Progress continued to be good over the next 5 days. Game was so plentiful that at one stop the men killed 29 deer. Lewis gave instructions to cook enough meat in the evening to last through the next day, so that no stops need be made for a noon meal. By this means, we forward our journey at least 12 or 15 miles per day. By August 7th, they had reached the mouth of the Yellowstone. Clark wasn't there, but signs of an encampment indicated he had been a week earlier. Lewis found a piece of paper stuck on a pole. It had his name in the handwriting of Captain Clark. Only a fragment could be read, but from it Lewis learned that at this site game was scarce and mosquitoes were plentiful, so Clark had gone on and would be waiting for Lewis downstream. I instantly re-embarked, Lewis wrote, and descended the river in the hope of reaching Captain C's camp before night. He was so anxious to reunite that he wouldn't take the day or so necessary to fix the longitude of the junction, as he had promised to do the previous year when clouds had made observations impossible. He didn't catch Clark anyway. Clark had moved on. In the morning, Lewis followed. He didn't catch up that day or the next. On the morning of August 11th, seeing some elk on a thick willow bar, he put in and set out with Private Crouzat to replenish the meat supply. After Lewis killed one and Crouzat wounded one, they reloaded and plunged into the willow to pursue more elk. Lewis saw an elk some yards ahead. He raised his rifle to his shoulder, took aim, and was about to pull the trigger when he was hit in the buttocks by a rifle bullet. This severe blow spun him around. The bullet had hit him an inch below his hip joint on his left side and passed through his buttocks to come out on the right side, leaving a 3-inch gash the width of the ball. No bone had been hit. The spent ball lodged in Lewis's leather breeches. Crouzat was nearsighted in his only good eye, and Lewis was wearing brown leather, so his first thought was that Crouzat had mistaken him for an elk.
"Damn you!" Lewis shouted. "You have shot me!"
There was no answer. Lewis called to Crouzat several times, still with no response. The shot had come from less than 40 yards away. If Crouzat couldn't hear him, it must not have been Crouzat who shot him. It must have been an Indian. In the thick willow, it was impossible to know if it was just one warrior or a war party. Lewis called to Crouzat to retreat, then retreated himself. He ran the first 100 paces until his wound